sports are still guilty of keeping and producing too many dark and ugly secrets.
From the University of Kansas Memorial Ballroom, KPR presents The Power of Sport. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, it's a conversation on race, gender, and athletics. Claire Smith was the keynote speaker at this year's Power of Sports Symposium, which marks 50 years of women's intercollegiate athletics at KU. Smith is a sports writer and news editor for ESPN. She was the first African-American woman to cover Major League Baseball sports, starting with the New York Yankees in 1982. This marks the fourth annual Power of Sport event, sponsored by the University of Kansas School of Business, the Langston Hughes Center, and Kansas Athletics. This year's event featured former KU basketball All-American Darnell Valentine, who went on to play professionally for Portland, Los Angeles, and Cleveland. It also featured Lafayette Norwood, who was the first African-American assistant coach in KU basketball history. And now, ESPN sports writer Claire Smith and the Power of Sport.
Wow. I was sitting here thinking about what I will take from this experience, and I project it to this time tomorrow evening, and it's going to give a whole new spin to the phrase, I'm not in Kansas anymore, because I will be truly sad, because I will have had to say goodbye, and also just want you all to know how wonderful this has been. Just thank you for having me. On Sunday, a lot of Philadelphians are going to be bragging about this game that's taking place, but I'm going to tell them I was at Kansas, and that's where Wilt Chamberlain walked and learned his profession, and no one product of Philadelphia stands taller, literally, figuratively, than Wilt Chamberlain. So thank you for all you did for Wilt Chamberlain. Wilt grew up in West Philly, and my mom's family, her parents lived there after immigrating from Jamaica, so she had to answer the question, did you ever meet Wilt? And she told me that she hadn't, but she saw him. She was sitting in a car one day, and a group of kids walked by the car. But one she could only see from the knees down, so she knew that she had just had an encounter with Wilt. I am so impressed and so grateful to the Langston Hughes Center and Director Sean Alexander for inviting me to participate in your fourth annual symposium on race, sports, and society. I would not be doing any justice to all the reasons Sean had for inviting me if I didn't add a category, and that's going to be gender. A lot of the experiences I've had, thank you, have come about because in my small list of pioneering events, more had to do with gender than race. But certainly as I don't separate being African-American woman, I don't split them up. It's often done for me. It wasn't the first time I'd been asked, but a student of Sean's asked me today what was more difficult, being a woman or being an African-American. Throughout my career, 36 years of covering or working for entities that cover Major League Baseball, never had one problem that I ever saw, felt, or sensed that had to do with race. It was really tough to be overtly racist covering sports that had many prominent African Americans in the locker room. They belonged to a larger family, if you will, and if they saw that racism spill over onto a journalist, they would have come to defense immediately. Time has not run out on being ignorant when it comes to being a sexist. Our headlines tell us that more than ever as brave women speak out. So much more of an issue for women to this day. to walk into predominantly male-oriented sports leagues and walk out unscathed. I wanted to get that out of the way, so I'm adding gender to this as well. Serving as the keynote speaker is not only an amazing privilege, but it's also an awesome responsibility. So I thank you again, Sean, for asking me. And truthfully, I also find myself asking a question that I've posed in my head a lot since being named the J.G. Taylor Spink Award winner, and that's, why me? I wanted to go to work every day, and 35 years later, my peer said, well, that was pretty amazing that you did that for 35 years. I only saw myself as literally doing my job, skating my lane, following a dream, but most of all, just being a messenger and being the best that I could at doing that. I saw the list of your previous keynote speakers. I can't construct a thesis or lead athletes and institutions to discover their better selves through the academic world as Dr. Harry Edwards does so capably. Try as I might, I'll never be the wordsmith that my friend and peer Bill Roden is. He's such a talent, such a mentor, and I thank him to this day. Thank you, Bill, for everything you've done for me. Yet here I am on this stage following the good doctor and Bill and Dave Zirin, the iconic political sports columnist, as a deliverer of this address. It's humbling to be in their company, to say the least. Where to start? I believe it will be with a request. Please allow me to revisit the who, what, where, when, and why. As journalism students, you know, the five W's of journalism, in order to examine how those five W's captured my attention, sparked my imagination for the last 39 years in this business. I believe these questions have everything to do with the reason Sean asked me here tonight, for they show the threads that help weave tonight's topics together throughout my life. Who am I? I'm an American. I'm an African American. I'm the great-granddaughter of a freed slave on one side, and the granddaughter of Jamaican immigrants on the other. I am the daughter of a mother who was a scientist and a father who was an artist. To me, Bernice and Bill Smith were two of the most outstanding members of the greatest generation within the greatest generation this nation has ever known. Their struggles and triumphs and their ability to love a nation that did not always love them back taught me invaluable lessons. They showed me an admiration of sports that was contagious. They so admired the abilities of games to show the value of the meritocracy systems that their tales of Jackie Robinson and Jesse Owens, Joe Louis, made such stars feel like part of our family. I was sharing a story earlier this afternoon about how my mother, who was born in New York City but sent back to Jamaica as an infant because her health was not good, and her grandmother back in Jamaica was the area's, I don't want to say, well, the country doctor. She was the midwife. She had the potions and all the cure-alls that could nurse this baby to health, and so she was there for her first 16 years. And she told me about how Jamaicans would sit in the little country store or in the homes that were blessed enough to have shortwave radios. And why would they gather? To listen to Joe Louis fights, to listen to hear tales of Jesse Owens, to look across the Caribbean at a country that really was to them that shining city on the hill, and dream of being a part of this. My mom, an American citizen by birth, finally came to America at the start of World War II. She was actually on a passenger ship heading to England to start a college career when the war broke out and all the ships were rerouted and sent to the U.S. And so she moved in with her parents, the maid and the chauffeur of a rich family in Philadelphia. She settled into Philadelphia life. She ended up at Temple University, a brilliant student, Hallahan High School, the girls' high of a Catholic school system there, and eventually followed her dream. She became a chemist after graduating from Morgan State. She worked in space program at General Electric in the missile system. I met the monkey that went into space as a little child. She helped invent a fuel cell that was put in the missile that took John Glenn into space. She was my hidden figure, but she was certainly my hero more than not. Dad was an artist out of Catonsville, Maryland. He graduated from the Philadelphia Museum of Art School, otherwise known as the place that Rocky ran up the stairs to to get his last exercise in. Proud Philadelphians, and I'm a proud Philadelphian and a proud daughter of Bernice and Bill Smith. My parents were my heroes, as I said, and their heroes were my heroes as well. And all from Mom and Dad to Rachel and Jackie and beyond, they helped make me who I am and helped guide me here tonight. My mom loved the Dodgers. She loved the Dodgers because of Jackie. She made darn sure that I loved the Dodgers too. And I did. I can't remember a time when I didn't know his story, didn't know Rachel's story. I was in third grade when the nuns at St. James Elementary School in Elkins Park, Pennsylvania, spirited our class to the basement, to the church, and showed us a movie, The Jackie Robinson Story, starring Ruby Dee as Rachel Robinson, but starring Jackie Robinson as Jackie Robinson. I knew his story, but to see his face, to hear his voice, to see the footage from games, I was gone. I was just hooked, and I've loved baseball ever since. Always knew that it would be in my heart, and eventually I figured out how to make it a part of my life. What am I? I'm a woman, one who works in a profession that still is attempting to find a big enough hammer to shatter still standing glass ceilings and walls across the board. And I cover sports institutions that are, shall we say, still noticeably male-dominated. And sports like corporate America, like the entertainment industry, like journalism, sports are still guilty of keeping and producing too many dark and ugly secrets when it comes to gender. Me too? Yes, me too. There are secrets about race, about gender, about biases too numerous to mention. They're being exposed today as never before, brought to light by women and men of all colors, from the tiniest and youngest of athletes to the mightiest players in Hollywood, Wall Street, and journalism. It is a movement that has entwined with our sports, with our society. There's no turning back. Time's up, you bet. What am I also? Well, I'm not a sports journalist. I am rather a journalist who happens to work at the art of covering sports. I chronicle, edit, and suggest. I watch and observe to the best of my ability. I think, and I seek to contribute to a greater product by helping to shape coverage that transcends sports, pushing myself and encouraging others to commit to seeing more than just balls and strikes. This all helps form part and parcel of the answer to my favorite question out of the five W's, and that is why. It is my belief that as journalists, we journalists are citizens not only of our departments, of our print or electronic media, of our sports shows, and our outlets, but we are also citizens, more importantly, of this nation and this world. As such, I truly feel we should resist siloing issues to the detriment of any one of the larger communities to which we belong. That is why I've always strived to explore how race and gender, sports and society intersect. These entities are inextricably linked, and no fiat from a government, a team owner, or a horde of Russian bots can make that not so. So from the Philadelphia Bulletin and Inquirer to the New York Times and now ESPN, that's the where, I've been afforded opportunities to have a seat at the table, to be that seat on a news desk or in press row. I am so blessed that after four decades to still be asked to be in the rooms where ideas are born. And for all of the above reasons, what I've been able to witness, study, and learn to become has become very much a part of who I am. The countless lessons found in the sacrifices of so many generations of athletes, sports executives, and yes, journalists who cover them are indelible. It may no longer be Muhammad Ali or Wilma Rudolph, Jim Brown or Bill Russell, Kareem or Bob Gibson being told to keep his or her place and keep their minds just solely on sports, or just entertain us and be grateful for the privilege. Today's athletes are being barraged with the same admonitions. Play, damn it. Don't think. Don't look to your communities and speak for them. Still, these players we cover do speak out, maybe more so than ever before. They dare to stage peaceful protest. He or she can still be seen taking a knee, bowing a head, or questioning everything from wage inequality to the animus behind a malicious nightstick swing or a suspiciously spent bullet or a certain badge. Like those who came before them, today's athlete can and does pay a price should he or she speak out. Just ask Colin Kaepernick. The former NFL quarterback to this day wears a target on his back that looks suspiciously like a presidential seal. And the just completed regular season in which quarterbacks were felled by the dozens, he still could not find a job in a league where he once starred. Other consequences? Countless NFL, NBA, and WNBA players heard their cries for justice for victims of police brutality and an off-skewed judicial system answered with venomous taunts that questioned their patriotism and insulted their mothers, and in the case of NFL players, maligned their manhood. These men and women chose to ignore the treacherous domains of public opinion and social media. They did so in order to assure that sports continue to play a significant role in the development of a healthier, more accepting culture. Thank God. Thank God for those who refuse to bow despite the risk to livelihoods and even still in our area, life itself. Now, to use your name and your notoriety on behalf of others certainly can be a vital tool. Muhammad Ali used his ability to wrap his defiance in both wisdom and wit. Jackie mixed grit and grace and a grim determination to sacrifice for the greater good. He hasn't played in over half a century, and yet he still inspires. He still certainly inspires me. Venus Williams, she defied tennis to justify its notion that women are not worthy of the same winnings as men. Venus, like the champion that she is, persevered. Yes, she really persevered. History shows there were prices to be paid for stepping outside the lines. The human toll taken won't be found in record books, but in the stories, the flesh and blood recounting. Jackie was old before his time, his body worn not only by a game, but by the choice to be the civil rights pioneer decades before Dr. King took the baton. Other lesser known stories were and are just as poignant. I'd like to share one in particular with you. Who remembers Willie Stargell? Oh, nice, nice. He was the chairman of the famed Pittsburgh Pirates Lumber Company, the man mountain who stood taller than Paul Bunyan in my eyes, whose bat seemed so small in his hands that it was often likened to a toothpick. But I remember Willie for another reason. I remember him for sharing insight into the America in which he was raised, a youngster who spent the bulk of his childhood in California. He did not know the overt racism of much of the South until his pursuit of baseball carried him to the Jim Crow South and the Texas League, where he was one of the first African Americans to play in that on that circuit. Texas is where that dear, dear man received death threats from the Klan and others who opposed integration back in the day. The vows to shoot him dead if he took his position in the outfield were as unsubtle as they were frightening. Willie, like Jackie before him, still chose to play. He chose the freedom of choice over fear. But he told me one day in his early go-rounds in the Texas League, a car beyond the outfield fence backfired. That noise, so like the shotgun blast he'd been warned could come his way, caused that mountain of a man, to use Willie's words, lose his water. Who says there's no crying in baseball? Because Willie cried that day, he told me that story. And so too did I. It's hard to imagine now that lives like Willie's, like Henry Aaron's, like Jackie's, and Larry Doby's, they were threatened because they had the audacity to want to play baseball. Livelihoods such as Muhammad Ali's and the Olympians Tommy Smith and John Carlos, too, were derailed or ended because of the athletes' political, moral, and ethical stances, or because they chose merely to exercise the right to peacefully protest. Countless other kinds of indignations were endured. Willie, as proud a man as I've ever encountered, told me of how teammates, well-meaning or otherwise, would rub his head for good luck. Why? Well, it turns out it was a throwback to the antebellum South, where rubbing the heads of those little statuettes of black stable boys, lawn jockeys, was a thing supposed to bring you good luck. Hall of Fame newspaper legends Sam Lacy and Wendell Smith, the fellows who put the stories of Jackie and other black athletes out in public, who championed their causes while pushing sports to integrate, they had their stories too of the indignities suffered in, with an amazing grace on their part. These great journalists from historically black publications had to buy tickets and sit in the stands in order to cover sports. Why? Press boxes were closed to them, even as Jackie and others integrated the fields. By the time I arrived, signs declaring that no women or children were to be permitted in press boxes still hung in some major league ballpark press boxes, and that was 1982. So you can imagine that when I saw those signs, barring me and any child I apparently would have taken to the press box, I could only imagine what they said just a decade or two earlier about race. The thought of such indignities make me nauseous to this day, and it reminds me to never forget the slaps and the slights others endured so that all of us might never have to suffer the similar outrages. So I choose to remember for Willie and Wendell and Sam, as well as all the other barrier breakers, my friend, new friend, Mr. Norwood. Now I know that Jim Crow is dead. I know that many of the most memorable legends to take the front lines of causes such as civil rights and gender equality have long been off the playing fields. Hard to believe, but Jesse Owens stared down Hitler way back in 1936, at the Olympic Games in Berlin. And Joe Louis and Larry Doby fought fascism in a world war that ended in 1945. Jackie and Branch Rickey, they joined forces to integrate baseball 76 years ago this April, this coming April. And Bill Russell walked with Dr. King in the 1963 March on Washington, ancient history to so many of you in this room. Tommy Smith and John Carlos, they raised their fist in Mexico City 50 years ago this coming summer. Their sacrifices enabled large segments of the subsequent generations of athletes to see beyond black and white. Now, some cynics might say the prior hardships allowed the privilege to see only green. I wasn't going to mention him, but you did, Darnell. So I look to Michael Jordan's generation, if you will, as kind of the lost generation, because people so easily disappeared behind their gated communities, sold products, and forgot that, A, many of the kids pining to wear their shoes were even hungrier for role models and direction to be good citizens, and all too many athletes wanted were the dollars that many of their parents could ill afford to spend. That selling of sneakers outstripped stumping for your fellow man for too many and for too long. Yet time, thankfully, did not completely diminish the lessons or legacies of yesteryear's heroes on the front lines. And today's activism and the need for it shows that what the old guard did remains relevant. In so many cases, that is so painfully clear. Who can possibly deny in this year of 2018 that race and sports and gender and their effects on society do not combine to make as volatile a topic as they did in the 30s, 40s, 60s, and 70s? Today's headlines and cries for justice are so similar to yesteryear's that it is an eerie reminder that the work is not yet done. It also makes one wonder, would not Jackie or Joe Louis or others have taken a knee, no matter the protests from the White House and beyond? There is such a time continuum to all these hot button issues. Thankfully, what also remains is a constant, and that is the time-honored belief held by many an athlete, coach, executive, and reporter that the stifling parameters drawn up by others, like so many foul lines and court boundaries, can and must be ignored. Colin Kaepernick and LeBron James, Venus and Serena, coaches like Greg Popovich and Steve Kerr, journalists like Jemele Hill, Robin Roberts, Bill Roden, they've all used their platforms. They've all used and risked their names and their celebrity to maintain their commitment to something larger than themselves. Whether their movements can be sustained, their commitments maintained, that really remains to be seen. Meanwhile, we shall watch, write, and record. And we will look for that telltale gesture, that turn of phrase that will remind of Ali again. We will continue to believe that we will know it when we see it, that stance of Jackie Robinson, that brave, brave man. When we do, the chills and the admiration that we will garner from that will make it clear that something more important than the playing and winning of games is taking place. So I consider it just that many of those who can so command audiences with their athletic skills have and will continue and choose to do more. Again, there will always be consequences. Just ask Mr. Kaepernick. But when such athletes and others connected with sports cross lines, others expect them to not fudge. We in the media will continue to ask why. And you, like I hope, will never expect to hear many regrets. We certainly haven't heard remorse or what ifs from Colin Kaepernick. When last seen, the one-time NFL quarterback was still not permitted to hold the football, but nonetheless still was holding his head pretty darn high. Yes, he sacrificed. He also persisted, and no one could ever ask for anything more. Thank you.
You've just heard Claire Smith, ESPN sports writer, speaking at the 4th annual Power of Sports Symposium at the University of Kansas. Smith was the first African-American woman to cover Major League Baseball and is the first female to keynote the Power of Sports Symposium. This event was held February 1, 2018, in conjunction with Black History Month and marking the 50th anniversary of intercollegiate women's athletics at KU. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. I'm Kay McIntyre, and now Claire Smith takes questions from the audience.
Thank you for being our keynote speaker and coming to our class.
Thank you for having me.
My question is, from your perspective, how has Black masculinity changed through the years in sports?
Ooh, well, not being a Black male, give me a second to think about that. I'm sure just as Hollywood's uglier days tried to use it as a weapon to divide the country, the first African-American athletes were presented as threats. You know, lock up your children, your wives, your mothers, your daughters, and demonized for being athletic. I went back into the newspaper morgue at the Philadelphia Bulletin. I'm sorry, I'm being very Philadelphian and swallowing my T's. The Philadelphia Bulletin's morgue, which is where all the clippings are kept, contained a lot of deceased newspapers. So I went back and looked up the articles written about Jackie Robinson the day that he first came to Philadelphia. The way he was portrayed and described by some of the most mainstream media in the country made me cry. I took the clippings out and I took them to my sports editor and asked him to please explain to me how in this country we could have noted newspaper people write, well, yes, he has the athletic skills, but he cannot make it because he doesn't have the mental ability to solve this game. He doesn't have the courage, he doesn't have this, or have him referred to in such terms that likened him to animals. Do we see that to this day? Oh, so-and-so, Daryl Strawberry is a natural athlete, he runs like a gazelle, he does this, he does that, but gee, his counterpart over there from the Caucasian race, he's a thinker. He's gonna be a manager one day. He works hard. The codes have changed over time. I think they still are used to denigrate far too many athletes. As far as the masculinity, I'm just, you keep asking me questions that I'm having a difficult time trying to describe. I hope that helped, but always be on guard for those terms. The football players who are here, please don't let anybody write more than once that you're articulate. That's an insult. Articulate as opposed to what? Are we supposed to be surprised that you can put a sentence together? You don't have to put a sentence together to be president of the United States, apparently. But somehow we're supposed to be astounded that a Black athlete can put a sentence together. So journalists, future journalists, mark that word, write it down, and please don't ever be tempted to use it to divide, because it is as backhanded a compliment as you can ever give. So is comparing an athlete to an animal, because it suggests that it's an innate thing. It's born in them. They don't have to work. Daryl Strawberry can wake up on Christmas Eve and run out a triple requiring no work, no forethought, no, you know, weightlifting or whatever. So it's still there. It's just a little more subtle, but it still hurts. It still stings. And it's not just, it's for any minority you want to identify as having these quiet slights. Tony Perez, Hall of Famer, told me that when he was playing for the Cincinnati Reds, he really fought like crazy to get a command of the language, English. He was born in Cuba. But after a game, if he had a big game, he'd watch the media go to Johnny Bench or Joe Morgan or Pete Rose to ask them what Tony was thinking about his big game. He played there for a decade in Cincinnati, and so there were reporters who never spoke to him. He moved on to Montreal, talk about a language barrier on top of a language barrier, had his first endorsement offers in Montreal, had reporters fight through the French barrier to the English barrier to ask him questions that he never heard in Cincinnati. These are such subtle ways of making a person feel small, making them feel lesser. And as journalists, that's just doing a bad job. And we should always be aware of that, how you're presenting yourself. Are you projecting the respect that you expect in return? So, boy, I'm sorry, I meander. I'm a bad interview. Okay.
I'm a former journalist, so you're going to get a current events question. Sure. I worked with Kevin Blackstone at the Dallas Morning News and Joe Drape when he was there, going back some years. Joe, I think, ended up at the New York Times, too. I'm a huge Washington Nationals fan. On tonight's topic, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about managers in baseball. We're still heartbroken about losing Dusty Baker. And will we ever see Jason Worth on a baseball field again?
Yes. The world never seems to run out of a place for Jason Worth to play. So, and this is probably why baseball players are not the favorites of football players and basketball players, because baseball money is just flat out guaranteed whether you play or not. And I love the headlines. Oh, it's such and such a quarterback signs for a gazillion dollars. And all I can think is, how much of it is guaranteed? It's not all, hardly any of it. So baseball has a real serious issue. Jackie Robinson would not celebrate Jackie Robinson Day every April 15th, I'm convinced, because the appeal of the game has been lost on the African American community with good reason, but there are also, I think, forces that are combining to push African Americans off the field and therefore out of pipelines to the front offices and to the dugout as managers and coaches. There were seven managerial changes in the offseason. Baseball has its Bud Selig rule, which commands teams to diversify their pools, their candidate pools. Not one African American was interviewed for one single managerial opening this winter. When asked about this, the commissioner of baseball said, oh, we're very happy with where the Selig rule stands because, God bless them, Alex Cora and Dave Martinez have jobs, and well-deserved. They're great baseball people. But baseball looks at its rainbow of faces, and they don't notice or choose not to notice that African Americans are systematically dying off in baseball. There were 13 teams with one or fewer African Americans. Very diverse teams, because there's Asia and there's Latin America, and there are people of all walks of life, color, in those clubhouses. But what happened to the Jackie Robinsons of the world? Where did it go so badly off the rails that African-American kids just choose to, are we choosing not to play? Do we not have the access to baseball? Baseball runs a Reviving Baseball in the Inner Cities League, but when it comes down to these teams and the rosters, they're just so few and far between. Adam Jones was asked, Adam Jones, the All-Star center fielder for the Orioles, was asked why no baseball players were taking a knee in support of the causes that Colin Kaepernick and NBA players were championing. And he said, because we can be made to disappear. He said that as the only African American on the Baltimore Orioles. The Yankees last year did not have an African American player. Every single Yankee wore number 42 on April 15th. But who do you go to ask why aren't you kneeling? There's no one to ask. There was a young man from Africa on the Pittsburgh Pirates last season, and I believe he's going to be on the Toronto Blue Jays this year. But I suggested to ESPN, I said, do you know that the Pittsburgh Pirates have more Africans than three major league teams have African Americans? It's just hard to understand and fathom what's going on. But the last year, the representation on the field among players was the lowest it's been since 1958. There were five starting pitchers. There hasn't been an African-American catcher in about two decades. I know that players' parents are saying, go to college, get your degree, take that scholarship. Baseball still isn't dependent on colleges to serve as its minor leagues. So therefore, hey, if I had a son who was playing sports and the choice was the Texas League for a $2,000 signing bonus or KU with a, you better go to class and you will have your degree, I'd push too. But I think there are other, maybe more insidious reasons for what's going on. A lot of theories going on. But the fact that no one got an interview this past winter when the Terry Pendletons and the Willie Randolphs and people are still waving their hands in the air it got a lot of people's attention, and I think you're going to be hearing a lot more about that before April 15th comes along. There's a lot of anger right now amongst the generation of former players who know that they used to have just a really nice niche in baseball, and it doesn't exist anymore. Yes, sir.
Where would Curt Flood fit in your pantheon of heroes?
Oh, right at the top. And I think that it's a disgrace that his peers haven't seen fit to put him in the Hall of Fame. I don't know if you remember Vince Coleman being asked about Jackie Robinson. I don't know nothing about no Jackie Robinson. There was a period where athletes really, it was all about me. So there was a lot of history that was ignored or belittled, what have you. You're talking about veterans committees now made up of the beneficiaries of this upward escalator that has yet to find the top, who won't vote Marvin Miller in. If you can't get Marvin Miller into the Hall of Fame, Curt Flood probably has so little chance to get in. I think Freud would love to get some of the players who are on those committees to explain why they don't support the men who made it economically possible to be the biggest and most powerful union in terms of earning money and earning rights, most powerful sports union in the world. I don't get it. So.
Hi, good evening. I'm curious, 3 days ago we got great news that the highly racist mascot of the Cleveland baseball team was removed, or will be removed at the end of 2018.
Yes.
I think it's progress, but I'm curious on your thoughts if that is enough, and B, if that will ever translate to the Washington football team.
Yes, so we had a wonderful discussion this afternoon in Sean's class about this. It won't be enough until the Native American populations, or even the population of one Native American, says our work is done. We no longer feel belittled or stereotyped by sports everywhere. My high school, Neshaminy High School in Langhorne, Pennsylvania, is apparently one of the 53 remaining schools in the country that uses the Redskins nickname. It's a controversy there, as I'm sure it is in every community that uses it. I like our chances, perhaps, of getting rid of it before the Washington Redskins team is forced to, because I see no pressure whatsoever from the league in trying to convince the Redskins that it's time for that to go. They support the Redskins and their right to use the name. It was long past time for Chief Wahoo to go. And Chief, it's not like everybody saying that Chief Wahoo is the same, the abomination is the same to use the logo on the Braves hat, because it's not a stereotype. It's not the Native American version of Little Black Sambo or the Native American version of the caricatures that Hitler used in cartoons to demean and disgrace the Jewish population. This is an ugly symbol. It demeans people. And it's its second dismissal by the Indians. Hopefully they'll never have to make that decision again. They brought it back, and it's very popular in Ohio. And I'm sure they gave them a year's grace period so that they can sell their product, move it off the shelf, but guaranteed they're gonna crank those out too. They're gonna make as much money off of it as possible, but they have committed to getting rid of it, and it's long overdue, in my opinion.
The last time we were talking about the Washington Redskins in any substantial way, which was kind of last season around a flutter of activity when the debate kind of was being reopened, on Pardon the Interruption, Tony Kornheiser and Mike Wilbon both said, they're not going to say the word Redskins on the air, they're just going to refer to the team as Washington. And it seemed to me that the sports writers such as yourself and sports commenters actually have a role to play in choosing not to use some of these words in print and in your conversation to refer to Cleveland rather than the Indians or otherwise. And I wonder just what you think about that, if you actually have that kind of control, or if that's an editorial decision that you don't get to control even at your level, at your stature, or if you think that's the kind of thing that could be, you know, in a way symbolic like kneeling, but really important if we were to start noticing a change in how people talked in sports.
I think ESPN has left it up to each individual on-air talent, and the numbers, I think, are large of commentators and play-by-play people. They have the choice whether to call the team by its city name or by its its nickname. I was sharing a story with Sean's class. Our newspaper in high school, the Playwikia, it's going on 3 years ago now, the students who run that newspaper got together and decided that they would not use the word Redskin. They would use Neshaminy. I thought it was brave and bold. It didn't cause a ripple. What caused a ripple was the school board convening a meeting and ordering the students at the newspaper to use the word Redskin. That was sorry. That was a bad day. It sent the terrible messages it sent to those students on so many levels. Don't think. Don't be yourself. Don't follow your conscience. And darn it, school tradition is more important than whether we're insulting anyone. Unbelievable decision. So I think that Tony and Mike have a lot more power, if you will, to do what they want, and I applaud them for that. I just put together notes for our game crews and for baseball tonight. I did not use Indians. I would certainly never use the word Redskin. I call them Cleveland. Cleveland's Terry Francona. No, I just can't bring myself to do that.
Hi, I appreciate you coming to our class early this morning. And my question is, I have two questions. So, do you think journalists play a role in creating colorblind racism? And also, do you believe that the mainstream media's view of black athletes requiring white supervision contributes at all towards the public's view of mass incarceration and the naturalization of it?
Certainly. I think that our discussion earlier about just words hurt, images portrayed, it can lead people to besmirch the hard work of any athlete using the phrases that suggest that black athletes somehow don't work as hard or have a disadvantage. We've heard Serena's feminism question, look at those muscles, look at this, look at that. And people will write those things or just off the cuff say those things without thinking of the consequences. What is the message you're sending? It's hard to write on deadline. It's hard to police yourself. But darn it, you have to. You have to, before you hit that send button, just as you all are encouraged, don't tweet until you read it again. Don't hit that send button. It's out there. You can't get it back. Words hurt. They really do. I once had a wonderful conversation with Ken Griffey Sr., who came into New York, and he had an amazing chip on his shoulder. He had walls built around him, and he lashed out at a reporter one day, and I took him aside and, what are you doing? Well, I've been treated badly in my life and this and that. I said, not by him. He's never written anything but laudatory articles about you. He treats you fairly. I know him. He's one of my best friends on this beat. What you did was wrong. And may I just share this with you, Ken. You're in New York. There were 12 newspapers at that time that traveled, or 9 newspapers that traveled with the team. He came from a city that had, I believe, 2 newspapers at the time. They're down to 1 in Cincinnati. There were radio stations with megaphones. WFAN and the advent of talk radio, if you will. And then there were all the local outlets that would descend on Yankee Stadium, so it always looked like a World Series was taking place. Couldn't swing a bat without hitting a reporter. And I said to him, you have to decide if you really want to go to war with people that have 1 million barrels of ink at their disposal. and go to war based on something that did not happen. I hoped that I showed them how it was going to bounce off of us and go back. We're humans. You slap at us, what's our first instinct? Sad but true, in a lot of cases, is to slap back, and slap back even harder than you hit. And by the time Ken was traded a few years later, I thought there were tears in the eyes of reporters, because he relaxed. He showed us an incredible insight into baseball. He was funny. Bill Cosby told Ken he should be in comedy. That's how funny he was. But the insight he brought, the honesty, the lack of cliches, the willingness to talk to us, to teach us something about the game he had mastered, it was electric by the end. It was a terrible day when they traded him to Atlanta. There was anger in the press room because we were going to miss him. And the relationship was great. We work on nurturing that professional relationship. I think that we just have to be honest with each other. We have to be honest. There was an African-American on Yankees that I stopped speaking to, because every time he saw me, he'd make a remark like, oh, I love women with big titties. And it just went on, and I stopped speaking to him. And he came to me one day and said, why don't you talk to me anymore? And I said, why don't you respect me for the job that I'm doing? And I told him exactly why. He apologized. And from that day on, we had a great relationship. So it really is such a two-way street. We do have probably more power than perhaps we should, but that's a war no one wins. And for the silly reasons it's often fought, it's just sad. It really is. It really, really is.
Thank you. You've just heard Claire Smith, ESPN sports writer, speaking at the 4th annual Power of Sports Symposium at the University of Kansas. Smith was the first African-American woman to cover Major League Baseball and is the first female to keynote the Power of Sports Symposium. This event was held February 1, 2018, in conjunction with Black History Month, and marks the 50th anniversary of intercollegiate women's athletics at KU. The Power of Sport was sponsored by the University of Kansas School of Business, the Langston Hughes Center, and Kansas Athletics. Thanks to KPR's Chuck Smith for audio of this event. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas. Did you know that most KPR Presents shows are archived at our website, so you can listen to them anytime? If you missed my conversation with Lawrence bestselling author Laura Moriarty about her latest book, American Heart, you can find it there. Or if you're heading to Kansas City's Union Station to see the Art of the Brick exhibit, you can catch my interview with Lego artist Nathan Sawaya, or the previous keynote speakers at the Power of Sports Symposium. It's all at kansaspublicradio.org. Click on News, then KPR Presents. And thanks for listening.